The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericaempowerment.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
I'm gonna make a change for once in my life. Gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collar on my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street with not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them? Disregard a broken bottle top and a one-man show. They follow each other on the wind, you know, 'cause they got nowhere to go. That's why no one yet to know. I'm starting with the man in the mirror.
Greetings and great day to all our radio listeners who have tuned into our broadcast on this day. You are listening to an hour of empowerment with Charles Haywood Ellis III. We welcome your comments, discussions, questions, and feedback to enhance our talk show. For that purpose, you can reach out to Charles Ellis at www.charleshellisministries.org. You can also follow him on Facebook at facebook.com/Bishop Charles H. Ellis, or reach out to him on Twitter at Bishop C-H-E, the number 3. And now, here's your host, Charles Haywood Ellis III.
Thank you, Trevis, and welcome all of our radio listeners in on today, and certainly hope that you will take time now to call your neighbors, your friends, and your co-workers, and to let them know that Charles H. Ellis III and an hour of empowerment is on the air. You can reach us on voiceamerica.com, and you can click on the Empowerment Channel, and they'll be able to join us today with the important information that we're going to be sharing on this day. I want to rehearse what Trevis shared with you. You can reach out to me, and we certainly welcome your comments and also your questions and concerns, and you can hit us up on Twitter at Bishop, C-H-E, the number 3. You can reach out to us on Facebook, facebook.com/Bishop Charles H. Ellis, and you can reach out to us on our website, charleshellisministries.org. We've got our sidekicks again. Trevis Colvin is here, and also Durrani Smith, and he's on social media. So again, feel free to send us your questions, your comments, and we'll certainly reach out to our guests at a later date and have those answered, and we'll get back to you. Today, we're going to be talking about the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. And we have a special guest on the line, and I'm so very happy to call him a friend of mine. He is Attorney Gerald E. Thurswell. He has been practicing law for 47 years. He received his Juris Doctor cum laude from Wayne State University when he was 23 years of age. He was the president of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, the Metropolitan Detroit chapter. He is recognized by his peers as one of the best lawyers in America. His law firm has a Tier 1 national rating from U.S. News and World Report in medical malpractice. Mr. Thurswell has handled many high-profile cases and cases with catastrophic injuries. However, he specializes in medical malpractice cases. He is licensed to practice in the law in the United States Supreme Court and in several states. He has received the highest possible ratings from multiple peer review organizations, and he is recognized in Who's Who in American Law and has been invited to be a special lecturer at several law schools. I want to welcome to our show on today, Mr. Gerald Thurswell. Welcome, Jerry, to our show on today.
Good afternoon.
and we're glad to have you, the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. I was noticing in your biographical sketch that you've been practicing law for about 47 years. I can imagine in those four-plus decades, you've seen laws evolve from one place to another place, and they're probably ever-changing with the various lawsuits that come up and the cases that come up before the Supreme Court and even federal circuit courts. So can you tell us a little bit about how the laws have changed over the 47 years that you've been practicing law? Does it favor the plaintiff more, or does it favor the defendant? Talk to us about that.
Well, when I started practicing law, if you believed malpractice was committed, you retained the services of a medical expert, and you got an opinion that malpractice was committed, and you filed your lawsuit, and you were able to take the case all the way to the jury, and a jury of the person's peers would make a judgment as to whether or not malpractice was committed or wasn't committed, and then they would award damages commensurate with those damages that you proved. If you proved that a person was disabled from doing household chores or unable to work, or if someone died, you would get the value of those services, the value of the life. And as the years have gone on, there has been what some people refer to as tort reform. And tort reform has really, you talk about, have the laws changed in favor of the doctors, the hospitals, or the patients? Well, it's gone totally in favor of the doctors and the hospitals, and the patients have suffered. Let me just give you some examples. The biggest example is there are caps on pain and suffering. What amount of money can an injured person receive when they're injured as a result of medical malpractice? You take a person who is retired. Somebody retires early in their late 50s or early 60s, and they suffer a devastating injury. In Michigan, their pain and suffering, their disability, is capped at $443,000. It doesn't matter if he's going to live another 20 or 30 years, no matter what the injury, he is capped for pain and suffering. You take somebody, he can barely walk, he uses a cane, he uses a walker, and for the rest of his life, the next 20, 30 years, he's supposed to be compensated at $443,000. His life is destroyed. He has no life, and that's what the cap is. If somebody dies and they weren't supporting their family, there is no economic loss. For example, someone has a child, they're in medical school, someone who's going to be a doctor. They go through undergraduate school, they go through 4 or 6 years of medical school, and they die. And they don't leave any relatives who they were supporting. And the family who has lost this son, this brother, the damages that they can collect, they're capped at $443,000. Someone who is burned severely, 21 years of age, is burned because of a procedure. We had a case at a local hospital here where a woman was having surgery. They had to put a hole in her skull to drain out some fluid. And they had put some alcohol on her face, and they forgot to dry it off. So when they went to drill, her face caught on fire.
Wow,
and she was severely, severely burned. And because there are no wage losses, she's got to live the rest of her life with a burned face, capped at $443,000. Now, that's just one aspect on the case. Many people talk about medical malpractice cases as being frivolous.
I was going to go there, Jerry. But before we go there, you're using some legal terms here, and I want to make sure that people understand what they mean. You said things begin to change when we started experiencing tort reform. just so that people are familiar with the word tort, what exactly is tort, and what does that mean?
A tort encompasses all civil wrongs. If you're in a car accident and you're negligent, you smash into another car, that's considered a tort. Tort is any type of civil wrong. It's a negligent wrong. Somebody is careless and results in injury to someone else. That's what a tort is. Sorry that I use that phrase.
No. I want you to use the phrase, and I just want to make sure that our listeners understand the terminology and the jargon of the legal profession. Now, I want to ask you a question before we get to the frivolous lawsuits and how people might feel about that and whether there's any merit to that or not. I want to get to the cap. You said that they came up with a $443,000 cap. Now, are we talking about one particular state, or is this across the United States? Is this a federal cap, or is this or does it vary from state to state?
It varies from state to state. Michigan started off at $250,000, and through the years, it has increased with inflation. In California, it's capped at $250,000, and it has stayed there, and it has never increased in California.
Wow.
So various states have various amounts on the caps, but it is... You take a young person who is severely injured, and there's no economic loss, because economic losses are not capped. But pain and suffering, disability, humiliation, that is capped. That's capped. We'll have cases, for example, during a delivery, a baby's shoulder gets caught. The head comes out, and the shoulder gets caught on one of the pubic bones. The head comes out, and the doctors apply excessive traction to pull the baby out. And the child will come out, and the child will have a limp arm. It's called Erb's palsy or brachial plexus injury. The child will have no use of that arm, ever, ever. And because the child has enough intelligence and they can get a job, they suffer no economic loss. But they live their entire life from
with
birth.
With a deformity?
Sure. With no use of the arm.
Wow.
Zero use of the arm. Zero.
Well, let me jump in here and ask another question. With this $250,000, say, in California or here in Michigan that has increased over the years with cost of living or inflation, I think is a better word or phrase, was there any methodology that came? I mean, did they just pull this $250,000 out of the sky? I mean, what was their methodology? Were there some accountants or some bean counters in coming up with some kind of accounting or methodology that they came up with that figure?
No, there's no rhyme or reason why they came up with the dollar amount. What happened was this, what they call tort reform. Insurance companies would collect the premiums from their physicians, from their hospitals. They would collect the premiums and they would invest them. Well, when interest rates started to drop and the insurance companies were unable to make enough money on the premiums that they were collecting, in order to increase the insurance company profit, they had to increase the premiums to the physicians. And then by increasing the premiums to the physicians, they then told the physicians to go to the legislature and pass laws so that they wouldn't have to pay out so much money. So it was an economic... I mean, everybody is responsible except doctors and hospitals. Everybody is responsible for full damages that they cause as a result of their negligence. Malpractice is professional negligence. If I smash into your car, you would expect full compensation for the damage to your car.
That is correct.
Whereas if a doctor takes away your health, causes you to become paralyzed, causes you to become brain damaged, they have caps. They're given immunity. And you'll have to explain that to me, because I don't understand why they should have this special privilege.
Wow. And when I hear you saying that, I guess I'm still bewildered or I'm perplexed as to how you come up with a $250,000. If this is the legislatures of the various states that are coming up with this number, you know, who are they engaging to come up with this number? I'm going to guess that they did not include the lawyers or the trial lawyers in this methodology or in this accounting, that they came up with it with another group that used whatever whatever process or whatever accounting to come up with this number. It just boggles my mind and perplexes that mind that you wouldn't get all the parties involved to try to come up with something that everybody, well, we didn't get what we wanted, they didn't get what they wanted, but we kind of met somewhere in the middle, and we all said, well, you know, if this is the best of a bad deal, we can all live with that. And I guess that perplexes my mind, that something as serious as this, and you know that it's going to be around for as long as we're going to be alive, that all the parties were not involved in this, that one side would take it upon themselves to come up with a number, with whatever methodology that they use, whether they thought it was fair or unfair. It just didn't seem like the process included everybody that it should have. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think the trial lawyers or the consumers, and it's really the consumers. It's really the patients don't go to the Capitol, and patients don't have a lobby group. The doctors have a lobby group. The insurance companies have a lobby group. When the lawyers go there, they say that the lawyers are just greedy trial lawyers. That's what that's what they say. So they only listen to the lobbyists from the insurance companies and from the physicians in the hospitals. It wasn't a good situation, and it isn't a good situation today. It just isn't. Nobody gets a privilege. Nobody gets damages capped other than physicians and hospitals. And this is almost throughout the entire United States.
So I guess we've always heard that the squeaky wheel gets the oil, but in this case, I guess it's those who financially support maybe the legislature, you know, they get the consideration. And really, that does not serve the electorate well, and that does not serve those who have put those people in place well at all. Surprised to hear that, but I guess that's just the way things are at the end of the day. We're going to come back on the other side of this break. We're going to go to a break early because I want a little more time in our next segment because I want to deal with maybe what some people call frivolous lawsuits and maybe how this has attributed into laws that are coming about that are not really in favor of individuals who have been wronged, individuals who have been offended, or who have been harmed. You're listening to An Hour of Empowerment. I'm your host, Charles Haywood Ellis III. Again, I certainly would hope that you would call somebody and that you would ask them to join in on the discussion today. We're certainly talking about the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. If you want to reach out to us, you can reach out to us on Twitter at Bishop CHE, the number 3, or Facebook by going on to facebook.com/Bishop Charles H. Ellis, or you can reach out to us on our email address, or I'm sorry, our website at charleshellisministries.org. And we certainly welcome your comments. We welcome your questions, and we will certainly pass those on to our guest, and he will certainly answer those at a later date for you. Again, we're talking to Attorney Gerald E. Thurswell, one of the very prominent lawyers here in the Southeast Michigan area. He is a specialist practicing for 47 years in malpractice suits. Listen, we're going to come back on the other side of this break.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
Grace and peace, my brothers and sisters. I'm Bishop Charles H. Ellis III, extending a special invitation to all senior pastors to join our exciting and expanding fellowship, Agape. This pastoral fellowship will provide a spiritual covering for you and connect you to the powerful anointing that God has placed upon our life. There are no yearly dues or fees aside from one initiation fee of $200. Remember that Agape is available to all senior pastors regardless of denomination or reformation. Therefore, won't you begin this brand new year by aligning and enhancing your spiritual endeavors with Agape, a graceful association of pastors ecumenically, and I hope to hear from you real soon.
For information, visit theagape.net. That's theagape.net. Or call us at 313-543-6069. That's 313-543-6069. They are classics from Charles Haywood Ellis III, illustrated sermons, that is, on-stage sermon dramas that bring the Bible to life before your eyes, like the Whip, Hammer, and Cross.
Judge him, Pilate! Judge him! Crucify him! And with his stripes, we are healed!
And the Horrifying, To Hell and Back. Thousands worldwide have been touched, even transformed, by these amazing stage productions. Get the DVDs at charleshellisministries.org. And don't miss his hot-selling books, Wisdom for Life's Journey, and Things My Father Used to Say, little treasure troves of wisdom and eye-opening insights that will take you to a new level of success. This and so much more is available at charleshellisministries.org.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
Welcome back to An Hour of Empowerment. I'm your host, Charles H. Ellis III, and we're talking today with Attorney Gerald E. Thurswell of the Thurswell Law Firm, and we're talking on the topic of the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. Mr. Thurswell has been practicing law for 47 years, and we've been talking in the first segment of this show about the various evolutions of the laws and whether they favor doctors or whether they favor patients and how maybe they have eroded over the time. And we've learned some new terms about tort and tort reform. We've also learned about caps being set on pain and suffering. And I would think, Jerry, that maybe some people would attribute these regulations that have not been so kind to patients who have been injured to what many call frivolous lawsuits. As a matter of fact, I hear people sometimes often refer to most all lawsuits as frivolous lawsuits. And certainly that could not be true, because then we would be saying that no one has ever been injured, harmed, or placed in danger because of someone's negligence. So since we all agree that that could not be the case, then can you help explain to us what might be considered a frivolous lawsuit, or maybe give us some statistics on the number of suits that are filed maybe in a year's time and the number that are thrown out because they have no merit?
We probably get in this office close to 100 phone calls a day regarding possible medical malpractice cases. Of the 100 calls we get a day, many days we don't take any cases at all, zero. We take very, very few cases. Because of the laws, and it's most in most states, in order to file a medical malpractice case, you have to have an affidavit from an expert of the same specialty of the person who you're going to be suing. If I'm suing a general surgeon, I have to get an expert who is board certified in general surgery. So these experts cost a lot of money. They charge us whether they find malpractice or if they don't find malpractice. So in the end, at the end of the day, we have to have somebody who has to have a serious permanent injury for us to invest the money to retain these experts. So the number of malpractice cases that are being filed in recent years is way down. In Michigan, it's somewhere between 75 to 80%. In certain portions of the country, it's down 90%. In Michigan, if we want to sue a general surgeon, we can get a general surgeon from any place in the country to testify against the doctor in Michigan. In some states, if you want to sue a doctor, for example, in Michigan, and this isn't the law in Michigan, you would have to get an expert of the same specialty in an adjoining state. So we'd have to get somebody from Illinois or Ohio, a state that borders on Michigan, in order to retain the expert. And these medical malpractice cases cost a tremendous, tremendous amount of money. Let's take a birth injury case where a mother is in labor, and probably 80 to 90% of the cases that I handle are birth injury cases. So a mother delivers a baby, and the baby turns out to be brain damaged. The nurses and the doctors looking at the monitor looking at the baby's heart rate, don't recognize that the baby's in distress, and they don't deliver the baby quick enough by C-section, and the baby's losing oxygen while the baby's in the mother's uterus. So we'll retain the services of an obstetrician to review the records. Then we have to retain an expert in pediatric neurology to prove that the baby's brain injury was caused as a result of lack of oxygen during these minutes before delivery. Then what happens is the doctor we're suing says, oh, guess what? There was a bad placenta that resulted in the injury, and there was no malpractice. So then we have to hire a placental pathologist. Then we have to hire an economist to help us determine what would the child have earned had the baby not been brain damaged. I have to retain the services of an economist. Then I have to retain the services of a life care planner. What kind of care and treatment is this child going to need for the rest of the child's life? Then we look at some of the MRI studies of the baby's brain, and they say, oh, this baby's brain wasn't damaged because of lack of oxygen during labor and delivery, and they'll hire a pediatric neuroradiologist. So I have to go hire a pediatric neuroradiologist. In some of our cases, we spend $150,000, $200,000 cash in retaining experts in so many different specialties, not just to prove that the malpractice was committed, but to prove that the malpractice resulted in a certain injury and the damages that this child or this individual has suffered. So they become very, very costly. And when I say spending this kind of money, $150,000, $200,000, I have to take the depositions of all of their experts, and they have to take the depositions of all of our experts, and we have to take the depositions of all the nurses involved at the hospital and all the doctors who were involved in the malpractice and the doctors who cared for the child after the malpractice. So they get very, very costly. So a lawyer is not going to take a case unless they believe, one, that malpractice was committed, and two, that there's a serious permanent injury. And what has happened now because of the way the laws have changed, what happens though, people can have malpractice committed upon them, and they can be injured. But if you're well within 6 months or a year, I can't take your case. It costs too much money. I can't take your case. Economically, I can't invest this kind of money when the recovery is going to be the equivalent of what I'm spending. So it's they use this word frivolous lawsuits all the time. In the area of medical malpractice, I can't believe there's any frivolous lawsuits because it costs so much. It costs so much to prove your case. No one would take a case unless they had, you know, real qualified experts to testify on all these issues. The malpractice, that it caused the injury, that there was no other cause of the injury, and the damages that the person has sustained. So
I am so glad that you shared that information because it really shined a bright light on this topic. And certainly I would hope that it has enlightened many of our viewers. Many of our listeners. And you have just enlightened me. And I see Treva's lighting up here, too. I think she's been educated, and Durrani handling social media. I think we all have been enlightened because we've also always heard of malpractice lawsuits regarding medical malpractice. And we all thought, you know, when you go get an attorney and you know, you prove that, you know, this happened when my loved one was in surgery or whatever the case is, and you know, you just sit back and it takes its own course. But now you have really opened the door and allowed us into that place that we can now see how things go, see how they evolve. And I was getting ready to say and cut you off and say, well, why would any attorney worth his weight take on a frivolous case? It doesn't make sense at all when now we understand the kind of investment that it takes. And just for the record, I want to make sure that our listeners are clear, you know, because you said sometimes it costs you $250,000 cash. And I don't want them to think that you're walking around with a briefcase full of 20s and $10 bills and $100 bills. And you pass, when you said cash, you know, that's just the lingo that's coming out of your coffers
That's right.
At the law firm. You know, you're not insurance money. You're not going out getting a loan for that and hoping that you're going to be able to pay that back. But that is coming out of the reserves of your firm. So your firm is depleted on that investment. So certainly, I don't know how any law partner would maintain a position in that firm if he is taking on those kinds of cases that absolutely have no merit when they are going to necessitate that kind of investment up front. So you have certainly helped turn the light on for us and helped us to understand. Let's talk about the doctors that carry malpractice insurance. Are all of them legally bound to carry malpractice insurance? Is there a way that they can get around it? I've also heard, I think some doctors work for medical centers, and then some doctors are in private practice. And I know that that's not your area of expertise, but probably since you've been engaged in opposition with these, you may know a little bit about that and be able to shed some light on that. So, you know, how does it differ when a doctor works for a medical center? He's on, let's say, their payroll, and then maybe one's in private practice. Is that malpractice insurance paid for by the medical center with that doctor employed, or how does all of that work?
You know, it's within our expertise, and it's very, very, very important because we look at that when we decide to take a case. In certain states, they require doctors to have malpractice insurance. Some states require them to have up to $1 million coverage. In Michigan, it was a particular hospital that required all their doctors to have malpractice insurance, and the courts in Michigan said, no, doctors do not have to have malpractice insurance. So in Michigan and many other states, I'm licensed in New York, I'm licensed in Illinois, Colorado, D.C., I'm licensed in a lot of states. So different states have different laws. In Michigan, a doctor does not have to have malpractice insurance. And in Michigan, many doctors just have a $100,000 policy or a $200,000 policy. And when you talk about somebody in the cases that we handle who have lifelong disabilities, who have to be cared for 24/7, who have to be tube-fed, who cannot walk and will never walk, who cannot talk, we handle some very catastrophic injury cases here. To sue a doctor who's only got a $100,000 policy and doesn't have a whole lot of money, it makes it almost impossible to sue some of these doctors when we learn that they have a small policy. On the other hand, doctors who are employed by some of these large clinics, doctors who work at the hospitals, who are employed by the hospital covers them. And the hospitals then have like unlimited amount of coverage. When you're at a teaching hospital and a resident commits malpractice upon you or a nurse commits malpractice upon you, the hospital is responsible. And some doctors do work for hospitals, but it's difficult sometimes to determine, is the person an employee of the hospital or does the person just have staff privileges at the hospital? If they just have staff privileges, then you're limited to whatever insurance coverage that physician has. On the other hand, if they're employed by the hospital, all employers are responsible for the people for whom they who work for them.
Well, let me ask you this.
So it's really important. It's really, really important. And we try to make that determination before we even file the lawsuit because you're not going to get blood out of a stone. It just won't happen.
Sure. Sure. Well, let me ask you this question. You know, just like we know that there probably are some lawsuits that have no merit, but probably a larger portion of them do have merit. We also have some great doctors and physicians and those in the medical professions, and then we have some individuals that cut corners, as we have in every profession in life. But in the medical profession, when you cut corners, people get injured for life sometimes, and certainly people die sometimes. It seems to me that most times there are major surgeries or whatever going on, there are multiple medical professionals in the room. So would we say that when we see malpractice taking place, I would think that the more people you have in the room, the less things would happen without somebody seeing something or somebody alerting somebody. Take us into those some of those malpractice
cases. That's a great question. That is a great question, and I don't think anybody in all the years I've been practicing and talking to people about cases, I don't think anybody has addressed what you have just asked, and it's a great question.
I'm going to tell you this then, Jerry, since it is a great question, well, it looks like we've got 4 minutes to a break. So let's
I'll make it really fast.
Well, no, we have 4 minutes, so go ahead and tackle it.
Okay. Let's assume in the case, in the birth injury case, where the mother is in labor and there's a monitor on, and the nurse sees that there's abnormalities in the baby's heart rate. And the nurse reports to the doctor, look, the baby's heart rate is dropping. The baby's heart rate is dropping. And the doctor looks at the graph and says, ah, it's okay, we'll just let her labor for a while. Nurses, the standard of care for a nurse, if the doctor isn't doing his job, the standard of care of the nurse is to go to her nursing supervisor and get another physician in that room to confront the doctor. Because the nurse is the second line of defense. That nurse is there to protect that patient. And if she sees that the doctor's not doing something appropriately, it's incumbent upon her to go to her supervisor and get another physician in there and tell that doctor, do this, do that. And we make those claims all the time, that the nurses are so afraid to do that that they just sit back. They'll record in the chart, I saw this, I saw that. But there's no record that the nurse then went to her supervisor or ever went to get another physician to talk to this doctor to do the right thing. That's what they're supposed to do. Most of the time they do it. Most doctors they save lives. They prevent injury. Doctors are great. But here and there, doctors like all of us, they commit malpractice. They're negligent. We've all been in car accidents where it's been our own fault. And when it's your fault, you have to be accountable. And physicians and nurses, hospitals, they all have to be accountable. The problem that we had that we addressed earlier today was they're not fully accountable. If I smash your car, as I said before, I'm responsible for full damages. Doctors, nurses, hospitals, in most states, they're caps. And they're limited as to what they're accountable for, which is, it's really outrageous. It really is.
I appreciate that. And I can kind of see where nurses, in comparison to doctors, you know, the doctors are these very towering figures and as important as nurses are, RNs or LPNs, whatever those terminologies are. I could see how, you know, people could get intimidated. But when you're talking about life and death, you know, you would really think that people would be proactive to not have something on their conscience. You know, it's one thing to note something in a chart. It's something altogether different to put the brakes on it and to get someone else in. Because at the end of the day, we are talking about life and death. And certainly it is unfortunate when individuals have the power to say something, but they don't say anything and somebody is gravely injured. And then you have these catastrophic injuries as well, or these fatalities. You're listening to An Hour of Empowerment. I'm your host, Charles H. Ellis III. Our guest on today is attorney Gerald E. Thurswell. We call him Jerry of the Thurswell Law Firm. And we're talking about the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. Again, we want you to reach out to us at Twitter, at Bishop C-H-E, the number 3. You can reach out to us on Facebook, facebook.com/ Bishop Charles H. Ellis. And you can reach out to us on our website at charleshellisministries.org. And we certainly welcome your comments and your questions. We're going to be coming back on the other side of this break for our last segment. And I certainly want you to stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Follow us on Twitter for more great ideas at Voice America Empowerment.
They are classics from Charles Haywood Ellis III. Illustrated sermons, that is, on-stage sermon dramas that bring the Bible to life before your eyes. Like the Whip, Hammer, and Cross.
Judge him, Pilate! Judge him! Crucify him! And with his stripes, we are healed!
And the Horrifying, To Hell and Back. Thousands worldwide have been touched, even transformed, by these amazing stage productions. Get the DVDs at charleshellisministries.org. And don't miss his hot-selling books, Wisdom for Life's Journey, and Things My Father Used to Say. Little treasure troves of wisdom and eye-opening insights that will take you to a new level of success. This and so much more is available at charleshellisministries.org.
This year, I'm getting my cup, get my healing cup, get my joy cup, get my happiness cup.
And you can get the enlightenment and uplift you need from the Amazing Grace Telecast, the broadcast outreach of Greater Grace Temple in Detroit, with Senior Pastor Bishop Charles H. Ellis III. Join us daily, Saturday through Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, on the Word Network.
Follow us on Twitter for more great ideas at Voice America Empowerment.
Welcome back to An Hour of Empowerment. I'm your host, Charles H. Ellis III, and our topic on today is the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. Our guest is Attorney Gerald E. Thurswell of Thurswell Law Firm. We just started left off talking about malpractice insurance and who is required to have it, who is not required to have it. Do hospitals or medical centers pay for it? Do doctors pay for it themselves? We talked about the number of individuals that are involved in most cases where people are being medically treated. And it seemingly you would think that the more people that you have involved, the less you would have these kinds of incidents and occurrences happening. But they happen all the time and far too often. And sometimes they happen to the extent to where people lose their lives. I want to try to shift gears here, Jerry, and talk about how long does a person have to file a malpractice suit? Are there statutes of limitations? And if they are, on what kind of cases, and what are those statutes of limitations?
In medical malpractice, it's different in the various states. Most states, you have to file a lawsuit within 2 years from the date of the malpractice, unless it happens to a minor. If it happens to a minor, some states let the minors sue up until the time they're 19 years of age. Other states, like Michigan, you have to sue by the time you're 10. So it varies in different states, but it's just so important that if anybody thinks that malpractice may have been committed, to consult with an attorney at once. Because let's assume you have 2 years to sue, the malpractice is committed upon an adult. It takes so much work. You have to get these medical records. It takes time to get the records. Hospitals, doctors don't send you the complete records. You have to go back and forth to make sure you get the complete records. And an experienced malpractice lawyer knows when he's getting the complete records. So you go back and forth, you get the records, then you have to send them out for review. One, to a doctor who's going to say malpractice was committed. Two, to a doctor who's going to say that the malpractice resulted in the injury. And then many times, as I indicated earlier, you may have to consult other experts, so it takes time. So if you think malpractice was committed, you should consult with an attorney immediately, because you can't consult a week before or a month before.
Let me
Another
ask you
interesting. This. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me ask you this: how long are doctors supposed to keep records? Let me just talk about my personal experience, and I've been going to a doctor here in the Southeast Michigan area probably since 1984. So I've been going to this doctor for, let's say, 31 years. So he comes in, Jerry, and he has now electronic apparatus now. But, a couple of years ago, he came with this big old chart. And I mean, this chart had papers, and it looked like a thesis booklet. And I'm sure that it was year after year after year, my medical records, and I haven't had any major things done. So for the most part, you know, it's just an annual physical and things of that nature. But it looked like he was keeping every paper on me from the time that I had started seeing him. And I don't know whether he was doing that because he has a good work ethic Or is there something legally binding him to maintain those documentations for a certain period of time? Can you share on that?
Yeah, various states have different rules as to how long they should keep the records. But a smart physician will keep them forever. But I want to get back to the statute of limitations. It's a very interesting law regarding the statute of limitations in most states regarding malpractice. Now, let's assume the doctor performs surgery upon you today, and it's malpractice. And he does something to you today, but you don't realize there's no injury for a year. There's
great
no
scenario.
Injury for a year for the malpractice that he commits today. You don't suffer an injury for a year. You don't have an injury for 1 year from the date the malpractice was committed. In most states, the statute of limitations begins on the day that the malpractice was committed, not the date that you suffer the injury. So what I'm trying to say is people who think they may have a malpractice case, whenever you think you may have a case, that's the time to consult a malpractice lawyer. And the other thing I would suggest, too, is that lawyers, it's that old saying, you know, I'm a jack of all trades and a master of none. Medical malpractice is such a specialty when it comes to lawyers. You know, people should retain the services of a lawyer who does nothing but medical malpractice. You can't handle three or four different areas of law. All, like 98% of what I do, 97% of what, is medical malpractice. And I'm learning every day. And it's not just the law on medical malpractice. It's the medicine. It is the medicine that I'm learning every day. And it's the experience in handling these cases and knowing the medicine that is so helpful. So to hire a lawyer who does three or four different things, and malpractice is one of them, it's not a wise thing to do. Not at all.
Well, let me stay in that vein because I'm certainly going to have you before we're done on today to give your information where people can reach you. And we heard you say that you're able to practice in some other states. I think you said Illinois, New York, and some other places. But certainly, I guess I would want to know from a person like a Gerald Thurswell, you know, what are some of the questions that I should ask attorneys or lawyers when I am engaging someone for these kinds of services? Because I'm sure that you have those who have great work ethic, and you have those who have otherwise. And if I don't know, and certainly I wouldn't guess that someone would be engaging in medical malpractice or any kind of malpractice lawsuits three or four times in their lifetime. So it's not like anyone would have any experience going in. So what would be some of the questions? If I feel that I have been wronged and I go to someone, and we see a lot of television commercials now, you know, about this free and that free and rhyming names and all of that, and we know that everything that glitters is not gold. What ought to be my protocol in trying to find someone who will not play games with me and not promise me pie in the sky and string me along, but someone who will be very frank with me and very honest with me to let me know what the status of my thoughts are and whether it's even worth going forward? So what kind of questions would I ask an attorney?
The bottom, I think the most crucial question is, other than medical malpractice, what do you do? And then when the person says they do this, this, and this, that's not the lawyer you want. You want the lawyer who does almost exclusively medical malpractice. 80-90% of his practice is medical malpractice. And then the next question is, how long has the individual been handling medical malpractice cases? There's really no substitute for experience. This is a highly specialized area. When you go to retain the services of a lawyer in an automobile accident, it doesn't take a genius to figure out who is at fault when you get rear-ended. It doesn't take a genius at all. And then you go to the person's treating doctors, and the person tells you what the injuries are and how that's going to affect their future. That's pretty easy. In the area of medical malpractice, it's the knowledge of the medicine. You have to be as knowledgeable as the physician that you're suing when you handle a malpractice case. Not only do you have to be knowledgeable in the medicine, but then it's not only the science of the medicine, but it's the art in questioning and cross-examining a medical professional. These people are very smart, and they try to avoid answering the questions, and they try to give you technical answers that you have no idea what the answer is. So you have to know the medicine, and you have to have the art of cross-examining an expert. It's a cute thing that I try to teach young lawyers here in the office. You'll ask the doctor you're suing a question, and he'll give you some technical answer. So I'll say to the young lawyer, say to the doctor, what if your patient asked you this question? How would you explain it to them so that they could understand it? And you dig and you dig and you dig. That's just a cute little trick we do here and there, but you need a lawyer who knows what he's doing in medical malpractice, who has the experience. There's no substitute.
I see sometimes on television commercials you have these large firms, and then you have not-so-large firms. Is there any validity into the kind of service that you might get? Sometimes people think with large, you don't get the intimate customer service. Sometimes people think with large, you have unlimited resources. How do you view that?
That's a good question. How many lawyers in this large firm do medical malpractice? Can they go to two or three other lawyers and just throw out a question? How am I going to cross-examine this doctor on this issue? What am I going to do? I think this is the way they're going to defend the case. So a large law firm can have a group of lawyers, three or four or five, doing nothing but medical malpractice, and that's fine. But you need a law firm, you need a large enough law firm or a law firm that's been around a long time that can fund these cases, because you can't cut corners in hiring experts. You cannot cut corners. You cannot cut corners in doing the research that you have to do, the medical research. You cannot cut corners. You have to consult with experts, even experts that you're not going to use, just to become knowledgeable on a particular issue. For example, in the birth injury cases, we have to get a placental pathologist, someone who does nothing but look at placentas all day long to see was the placenta functioning appropriately, was there some type of infection in the placenta that caused the injury to the baby, and it really wasn't the lack of oxygen during labor and delivery. You need a law firm that has the resources to fund the case. In the event that the case has to go to trial, because there is a certain percentage of these medical malpractice cases that don't settle, and you have to go to trial on them, and you have to have the funds to be able to bring these experts in from California or from the state of Washington, from Florida. You've got to fly them in. You got to put them in a room overnight so that they can testify the next day. You got to fly them home. They don't like to fly coach, not when they're doing you a favor to come to testify. So.
And there you jumped into my last question. You know, how many of these cases or suits commonly go to trial? Because I would think that the hospital or medical centers or doctors would probably look at who they're going up against. And certainly if the firm does not have a reputation of having the deep coffers to be able to sustain this kind of push into a trial, then they would probably wait it out and drag it along and try to bluff their way to make it go away.
Make it go away, or make it go away cheaply, because the lawyer can't continue, because they have unlimited resources. So you need a law firm that can fund the case all the way to the end. But interestingly enough, about cases going to trial and which ones do and which ones don't, I think the great majority of the cases, probably 90% of the cases, in the states that require these affidavits that I was talking about, probably 90-plus percent of the malpractice cases settle. But there is that 10% that don't. And the 10% that don't, they think they didn't commit malpractice, and they have experts that will say that. And then there's also a totally other issue. There's another issue that... when a physician is the defendant in the case, many of the malpractice insurance policies require that in order for the insurance company to settle the case, they have to get the doctor's permission in writing. And many doctors just refuse to consent. So if the doctor doesn't consent, it doesn't matter how meritorious the case is. The case has got to go to trial because the doctor won't consent to the settlement.
And on that note, our time has gotten away from us, and I certainly hope that all of our listeners have enjoyed the show on today. You've been listening to an hour of empowerment. Our guest has been Gerald E. Thurswell, attorney at law, the Thurswell Law Firm. We've been talking about the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. Tell us very quickly, how can people reach you? Do you have a website?
We have a website. I think it's called Thurswell Law. And we do handle cases all over the country. We handle malpractice cases all over the country, not only in the states that I'm licensed in, but if we have cases that arise in a state that I'm not licensed, we get permission from the Supreme Court of that state to handle the case in that particular state. So,
I want to thank you for
being here. Thurswell Law, and we do have a website, and we do have a toll-free number, and we have two lawyers. I was telling you, we get 100 calls a day, at least. You can call the office, and a lawyer experienced in medical malpractice who does nothing but answer the phone calls will tell you whether or not you have a case worth investigating and pursuing.
I appreciate you for being our guest on today, and you can always go to charleshellisministries.org and get information on the Thurswell Law Firm. You've been listening to An Hour of Empowerment with Charles H. Ellis III. I certainly hope that you've been enlightened and you've been blessed on today by the information regarding the ever-changing laws regarding malpractice suits. We'll talk to you, and we hope that you will join us on next week. Have a great day.